Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Sutter of the Democratic World Federalist, member of the club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for today. We welcome any viewers or listeners and invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. We're pleased to have Professor Fernando Adolfo Iglesias as today's speaker at the Commonwealth Club. He flew in from a conference in New York and has recently had a meeting with the Democratic World Federalists and will be heading back home to Buenos Aires on Friday. Fernando Iglesias from Argentina reportedly has three citizenships: Argentine, Spanish, Italian, and he may eventually become a citizen of planet Earth. Muda mudan. He's been a columnist for Revista Noticias and La Nación. He's been professor of international governance at the University of Belgrano in Buenos Aires and professor of globalization and regional blocks at the University of Business and Social Sciences, usually called UNCES or UCES. So you could say that Professor Iglesias is a theoretician, but he's also an activist. And in Western Europe, activists are called militants, so beware. He has served in the lower house of the Argentine Congress, but he opposes ultranationalism, something that seems to be growing in this country. He's the founder and vice president of Democracia Global, Movement for a South American Union, and the World Parliament. You could say that he supports regional or continental unity and also federal global unity. Excuse me. In 2005, Professor Iglesias wrote an article, South America, the Hard Choice Between Bush and Isolation, which we've printed in our quarterly toward Democratic World Federation, and there should be copies out on the table at the entry. Then in 2006, he published Globalizar la Democracia, pardon my Spanish, por un Parlamento Mundial. I think that means democratic globalization, at least I got the for a world parliament. So, but let's hear from Professor Iglesias himself. He will be speaking on a manifesto for global democracy. Is this a new step or just a mirage? Join me in welcoming Fernando Iglesias.
Thank you, you all, for being here, and especially thanks to the Democratic World Federalists of San Francisco for their job and their commitment to the principles of world federalism and democracy. Thanks to all their members, but particularly to John Sutter, who invited me to be here. I am really proud to be in San Francisco. I'm very glad, and I want to say to you also that I appreciate your being here. What we are going to speak about, a document. I hope any of you have a copy, just in case you want to make some questions, or when I finish my speech. But it's also important that you know this conference was organized by a chapter, a local organization, a chapter of the welfareist movement, of which I am the chair of the council. And in case you want to meet the people and join the organization or know more about their activities, the members, the president, Roger Cotilla, and Bob Flax are there just in order to help you. Well, let's start about this Global Democracy Manifesto. What is this? This is about three or four years were years in which in many, many places all over the world, people went to the streets in order to complain about how the things were going on. And they were there in order to complain because they didn't feel they were well represented by their governors. They didn't think that they had a real participation in the decision making that affect their lives. And the kind of complaints were very different, but these were common points between among the different groups, meaning the indignados in Spain, the Arab Spring, people in the Egypt squares, people now in Brazil, and an amazing quantity Occupy Wall Street, and all the different movements that were expressing this discontent of the citizens of the world about the current global order. So maybe, as I say, they had different complaints and they had different visions and they were facing different problems, but there was this strong relation, in my opinion, about the need of reshaping the way in which democracies were dealing with concrete problems. So, by those times, there was a statement that Tony Negri and Noam Chomsky made about the situation and what to do and what was the problem about. And it was very interesting, but at the end, it was a little biased in a political way. So, and a group with me, I'm part of a small organization in Argentina, Democracia Global, started to think that that was a good opportunity for trying to put together some principles and some possibilities and some perspectives, but also some proposals about the future of the war, about the future of a war in which everything, as George Monbiot have said, everything got global but democracy. And so we started to think that there was some kind of consensus of common points among writers and political thinkers and members of the academy about some principles, even if their political thoughts were very different from the leftist to the rightist part of the political landscape. So I made the decision of trying to write a manifesto in order to put together these principles, and that and my intention was to be as pluralistic as possible, just to put the things in which almost everybody could agree. So I prepared a draft. I discussed the draft with some of my friends, which are there. We made some correction, and we started by 30 signatories. The people, this is the first of the slides. You are going to see now 30 slides of the different signatories, and you are going to see that they came from very different countries, from very different cultures, and from very different political parties or ascriptions. But we were able to establish a basic consensus about two or three things which are in the document. Basically, which are the basic statements of the Global Democracy Manifesto? The first statement I would say is there are global problems. We are facing for the first time in the human history, meaning phenomena and processes which are completely overcome, which have completely overcome the level of national organizations and have become supranational, international, and global. Meaning climate change, meaning nuclear proliferation, meaning financial crisis, meaning global terrorism, meaning crimes of war, meaning mafia and drugs and trafficking of drugs and people and arms, etc., etc. This is something in which I think everybody agrees. The second statement I would say is this global trouble, this global crisis requires global solutions. They cannot be managed at the local level. They cannot be managed at the national level, but they cannot be managed at the international level. The international level is not the global level. The international level is a national level. Meaning, if we were to solve a problem and we are in a table with other 20 people and each of us keep in mind first to protect his own interest and the interest of his nation, and this is more important for all of us than solving the problem is not going to be solved. And we are facing a lot of situations in which global trouble are trying to be managed at the international level, like one example is climate change and Kyoto Protocol and all things, which are better than nothing, but are completely insufficient to cope with the problems. And the same thing is about many other things, global poverty, social injustice, the dealing with AIDS and global pandemics, etc., etc. So international institutions, which is what we have, United Nations is an international institution. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, etc., etc., etc. They are not global. They are international. They are national parts putting together, trying to keep their own interests instead of solving common problems, instead of defending common global commons. So the second statement is about the international organization being unable to solve global trouble, so global crisis and global problems require global solutions. And this is the open door for a third statement, which is this global solution has to be democratic. Because if these global solutions are not democratic, are not delivered by democratic institutions, you have an unbalanced representation in favor of the most powerful, which is usual result of the imbalance of power in any of these international institutions. If you don't have democracy, you have the power of those who are powerful, meaning the big nations over the small nations, the developed nations over the undeveloped nations, meaning the financial system on the economy, and meaning the economy on the lives of people, etc., etc., etc. We need democracy, and this is one of the reasons for democracy. Democracy is about two things: protecting the interests and the rights of those who have no power, and democracy is also about the right of people of participating on the decisions that are shaping their lives. And no, we can discuss which is the degree of democracy in our countries, but for sure we are not having any kind of democratic organization at the global level, and we are all paying for that. The second, I wish to make another observation on this. When I wrote my first book 13 years ago, the book was Republic Affair, the reaction was very skeptical. Everybody started to say, well, you know, this is some kind of Martian thing. What are you thinking about? This is a Republic Affair, a world parliament. It was something completely disconnected with the feelings and the perception of people. Now, when I wrote my last books, I published my last book, the reaction was quite different. The reaction was, you know, this is too much on the vanguard. This is maybe some kind of Star Trek thing, but this is going to happen. I feel this is going to happen maybe in 50 years or 100 years, but this is something rational. This is not enough for me, but the change is amazing. So in only 13 years, which is nothing in the history of humanity, our perception about this kind of trouble and this kind of problems has changed amazingly for all the citizens of the world. And it was because a lot of things happened in the last decade. You know, September 11, but the global crisis, the financial global crisis, and Lehman Brothers falling down, and the Arab Spring, and the menaces of climate change being really clear for us. So many global troubles, the importance of global institutions became are becoming more and more evident for us citizens of the world. And this is something which is important to say, because now we perceive that this is not about building a global institution, global democratic institution. This is about democratizing the global institutions that we already have. We have a complete set of global institutions which are not global, which are international, and which are in charge of managing global affairs with nobody has asked them to do so. I mean, for security, we have the United Nations Security Council. For economy, we have the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. We have also the World Trade Organization. We have a lot of agencies. We have also now the G20. Which is something completely new. 10 years ago, it was the G8. Some years before, there was almost nothing. And now we have the G20, which is another international organization with no rules, with no democracy, with no transparency, with no accountability. So the problem now is not, the discussion is not about building global institution, which is, we are afraid about some kind of global tyranny. The problem is we have the institution and we're risking to go into the tyranny of the most powerful institution and nation of the world. And that's why we need to democratize the power in order to participate on the decision and to, in order to manage the concrete problems, but also in order to avoid the possibility of going into some kind of global tyranny. What else? I was wondering about what do we need for arriving to democracy. Democracy was born not in national states. Democracy was born in cities, in Athens, and it developed into national state in a particular moment of history, which I wish to recall. Because it's very important to understand that the political power doesn't use to born in a democratic way. Usually, we change from anarchy to govern, from anarchy to political power, but at the origin, the political power is not democratic. It was a complete exception, the history of the United States and American nation. Usually, when the nation were created, they were not democratic. There was monarchs, there were kingdoms, and kings and queens, and so on. And after that, the power became democratic. What were the conditions for that? In my opinion, there were four conditions. The first one was about thinkers. I would say thinkers. What do I mean? I mean, before having national democracies, we had a lot of thinkers who were writing about democracy before democracy existed at the national level. Montesquieu, Rousseau, Kant. There are a lot. You can't find your favorites, but there were a lot of very developed thinkers in politics that were putting together the different things that were important for the building of a democracy. The Federalist Papers about federalism, but also Kant about cosmopolitan need of sharing the world together, and Montesquieu about the balance of powers and the three separate powers, and so on. So, this is a condition, thinkers. Second condition was the change from a system of production to a new one. So, monarchies and kingdoms and the feudal and monarchical order was in the age of agrarian, in the agrarian age. I mean, the agrarian age was directly connected with a way of managing political decisions, and which was not democratic, which was monarchy. But then we had the Industrial Revolution. As we have the Industrial Revolution, we had in parallel with this, in a very long period of time, also the political revolution, the French Revolution, the American Revolution. And these were directly connected. It was an amazing change from the times of the agrarian system and monarchies to the new system, which was industrial in the economic way, but it was democratic in the political way. Now we are facing a similar change, because we are facing the change from the industrial way of production to the post-industrial, the global society of information and knowledge, whatever you call this. We are producing things, we are doing things, we are communicating with other people, we are dealing with the production of material things, but also with the production of information in a very, very different way of respect to the Industrial Revolution, respect to, say, 30 or 50 years ago. So this second condition, which is a huge and important change in the techno-economic structure of the world, is happening again. And the third is of the condition is about people. People going into the street and claiming for their rights. This happened also when we had national democracy. You know, the capture of the Bastille in French was the most emblematic situation, but it happened all over, with people going into the street as social movements, as worker movement, etc., etc., etc. And what was that about? What was the capture of the Bastille about? It was about people recognizing that there was a system that was insufficient and expressing their will for a change and destroying or capturing the symbols of the old power, the ancien regime, the monarchies, which were the prison of the Bastille, and they went there and they destroyed and they try to change the thing. They didn't know exactly what they were looking for. They did know very, very well what they were opposing to. And this is exactly the situation in which we have Occupy Wall Street, Arab Spring, Indignados in España, people in Brazil going to the streets, trying to capture the Bastille again and trying to change the things again and trying to build a new way of democracy again. In my opinion, all these elements we have together, the four element is still the lacking element. For those times, we had organizations, political parties, meaning La Montagne and the different parties of the French Revolution that were important enough that were trying to promote the political change. And now we are just starting with a small organization like the Democratic World Federalist, but also Democracia Global and the World Federalist Movement and many other initiatives that are going on. You should only check on the online and Google a little for finding an enormous amount of initiatives in this direction. But our organizations are still weak. We are still few, and we have no resources, and we need to work together. But this is a start. Where is the Global Democracy Manifesto in this? Well, this is the Global Democracy Manifesto tries to support this process, this change towards a global democracy, towards world federalism, by putting together thinkers, which is one of the elements we consider. I think we, for the first time, we had 30 signatories of first level in their capacities, very well-known people from left, from extreme left, I would say, like Chomsky or Tony Negri, to liberal, to social-democratic, and all of them have many differences, but all of them agreed on this statement, and I hope this is going to be something important for the future. What else? The future. Well, we have developed the document. We have reached this kind of consensus, and we have launched this manifesto in different parts of the world. The idea is having many launches, many conferences of some of the signatories speaking to the audience about the principles and discussing the principles of the document. And we had this first in London at the London School of Economics. Then we went to the Italian Senate. Then we went to San Sebastian in Spain. Then this year we launched in the document in Buenos Aires at the Ferry of Books, which is the most important ferry of books of South America. And every time there was an increasing success in public and press, etc. So the program is more or less, we are going to have for sure some kind of conference of launching also in Sciences Po in Paris, the university, the political sciences. And we invite any of you here in San Francisco and in other places of the world to prepare a conference, to invite some of the speakers, and first of all, to invite other intellectuals that want to join the movement and that want to sign the document and being part of the initiative. I think this is directed in two different ways, and I'm going to finish here in order to allow you to make questions. In some way, we hope that the document is a valid document for the elite, for all the people who are in charge of dealing with the global problems, and we hope to contribute to their capacity to understand what is needed. And what is needed is the building of new institutions, the reshaping of all institutions. If you read the document, there are some very, very concrete proposals. I'm going to read only this. We call for the urgent creation of new global agencies specialized in sustainable, fair, and stable development, disarmament, and environmental protection, and the rapid implementation of forms of democratic global governance on all the issues that current intergovernmental summits are evidently incapable of solving. And there is another one. I should have. This is. The existing national state organization have to be part of a wider and much better coordinated structure, which involves democratic regional institutions on all the continents, the reform of the International Criminal Court of Justice, a fairer and more balanced International Criminal Court, and a United Nations Parliamentary Assembly as the embryo of a future World Parliament. Yet, this institutional change will not be successful if it only accrues from the action of a self-appointed elite. On the contrary, it must come from a socio-political process open to all human beings with the goal of creating a participative global democracy. Well, these are very concrete proposals about what to do in future, and I hope, we hope, that the leaders of the world could pay attention to these concrete proposals. On the other hand, our hope is that this document helps people all over the world, and particularly those who are committed with social movements like Indignados or Arab Spring or Occupy Wall Street, in order to change, to improve from the stage in which they know what they don't want, but they don't know what they want, to a new stage in which is we know what we want, and this is global democracy. Thank you very much.
Okay, our thanks to Fernando Iglesias for his talk on a manifesto for global democracy. Well, we'd like to remind our audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and I'm John Sutter, member of the club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for today. Now, Professor Iglesias will now take some questions.
Professor, would you say a little bit about the European Union? How successful has it been? I know we haven't had a good war between Germany and France lately, but what is your assessment of the European Union's success?
Well, this is a very good question. After the two wars, we had two developments, two political developments that overcame the national level. And this, they were, in one hand, to the global level, United Nations. We are in San Francisco. I don't have to explain you what was that about. And the other one was at the regional level, which was the European Union. So I have to say that the results were extraordinarily good. I mean, the United Nations were created in order to avoid the Third World War. That's what the United Nations about. All the rest is okay. Human rights, the Declaration of Human Rights 1948 is amazing. But the basic thing was just avoid, let's avoid the Third World War. That's what. And this was a success. Of course, we need to change the United Nations. We need to democratize the United Nations. We need a United Nations Parliamentary Assembly in order to do so, etc., etc. But let's recognize the good part of the result. And the same is for Europe. The same is for Europe. So even in this crisis, and in this horrible crisis in which Europe is still, if you check at the UNDP program, so United Nations Development Program, which is the most accurate radiography of the state of the world, among the 10 countries which are the most developed in terms of productivity, but also education and health and et cetera, and social aspects, from 10, 6 are European countries. 6. And 4 are part of the European Union. I mean, of course, disemployment is a terrible thing and has to be fixed. But when there was no European Union and the national sovereign states of Europe were in charge, this kind of crisis, like in 1929, were solved not by 20% of unemployed people. This kind of problems, this kind of crisis, were solved by 20% of dead people, you know? Because we had 60 million people dead in the Second World War, and it was about economic crisis. I think this is a huge improvement of the situation. Of course, the problem of Europe have two problems. One of these is internal, and the second is external. The internal problem is that they created a currency without a government, an economic government of the Eurozone. So you have some kind of imbalances that are not so strong here in the United States in some way, because you have a federal government together with the national currency. But so Europe has an internal problem in order to become more united and more federal than it is. The second problem of Europe is this. We are in the age of globalization. And now, if you are a Spanish worker, say, and you enter into a factory, you earn 10 times what a person in China is having for the same work. You know, 10 times. It's $300 versus $3,000, more or less. So this is an amazing difference. And in a global economy, which is becoming more and more global, and it's going to be more and more global, you can keep your system of social, your social system and your welfare system without globalizing the social system. So Europe, the problem of Europe is not like nationalistic people used to think, that it's too big. The problem of Europe is it is too small. Because if you are going to keep good social conditions, you have to globalize good social conditions. If people in China is doing the same job for one tenth of the salary of Europe, the situation is very clear. The social situation in Europe is going to degrade, and we are going to face against the risk of national populism, Nazism, etc., etc. That's the two problems that Europe has to solve. But it was an amazing situation. Let me put the thing, and I finish here about Europe. So the process of building the European Union started in 1950 by the Schuman Declaration. 1950 is the middle of the 20th century. So if anybody comes to you and asks you and say that he's very critical about the European Union and blah, 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 you ask them, so you let me know, in which Europe do you prefer to live? In the Europe before 1950 or after 1950? Do you prefer to live with Hitler and Mussolini and Franco and the Jewish genocide and the war, two world wars, in the Europe of sovereign states? Or you prefer to live in the Europe of the building of federal institutions at the regional level? This is very simple. And of course, I'm very critical, and they have to change the things. They have to go to federal government of economy, and they have to put money and save people for unemployment, etc., etc. But keep in mind when we are speaking about the United Nations and the European Union, which had been the amazing result of the first step of the globalization of the political system in the past century.
Thank you much for a wonderful talk, and it's a wonderful initiative. The problem that I see in this country is we've lost our faith in our democratic institutions, even in this country. And if you think about Congress, which is, you know, of the people, by the people, for the people, supposedly the institution that represents us in the democratic system, we've lost faith in much of our country in that particular institution. And it seems to me that people will not gravitate toward a larger vision of institutions until we begin to talk about how we solve it here. How would you answer that question?
That's a very good question, and my answer is not that good, but I'm going to try. Well, you know, we are, when we speak, so the fact, I don't agree that people lost their faith on democracy. They lost their faith on the way in which democracy is dealing with things. And what's the problem about? So the most developed societies all over the world in which the conditions of life, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm going to come back, I know. Anyway, I mean the United States, Canada, maybe Japan and European nations were in which they were not perfect societies, of course, but if you analyze the level of social equality and the level of democracy and human rights, etc., etc., these were the best societies in the history of humanity. That's it. It's very simple. With all the imperfection, with all their colonialist and imperialistic policies, etc., but they were the best societies that we human beings have been able to build. So, they were based on a balance between the power of politics and the power of economy. The economy was basically national, and the politics was basically national. And there was some kind of balance, conflictive, with, you know, predominance of one on the other, and then the change between these two basic systems in which modern life is based on, which are the political system based on the principles of democracy, social justice, you know, human rights, justice, etc., and the economic system, which is based on productivity, capitalism, etc., etc. There was a fight, but there was a balance, you know, between, in one hand, the corporation, in the other hand, the government, but also the social movements and the syndicates and the workers, the trade unions, you know, there was a balance. Because of the amazing technological change, this amazing change in the last 20 years opened extraordinary opportunities for becoming global because of communications, because of, I'm not going to develop all the, but you know about how fast we can now reach every point of the world for sending a message or having money or whatever. But the economy was very smart and in order to use all the opportunities. So the economy became global, and became global particularly the financial system, which was the easiest system to become globalized through internet and global markets and etc. So now the balance of power was completely disrupted, and the power of global capitalism, global economy, global finances was surprisingly stronger than the power of national politics and national democracy. That's why people are so discontent about the results. They look at the political class and they see that they are not solving concrete problems and they are being corrupted by the power of economy. And that's the problem. We need to reestablish. Is that okay? Reestablish? To balance again the situation. But there are two possibilities for this. We have a global economic system, which is based on internet, technologies, etc., and global capitalism, etc., and we have national democracies, which are trying to become international a little, and they come back, you know. So the two possibilities are this. The first is putting, again, the economy and the society at the national level. Let's go back to the golden age of national states. And this is a reactionary program, you know. This is a reactionary program. We can see this in Europe, you know, saying we are Greeks or we are Italians, we are Spaniards, so let's go outside the European Union, go back to our national currency, put away all these immigrants. They are not Greeks, they are not Spanish, and come back to the past. And this is a real menace, because this was the idea at the beginning of the 20th century. This was the idea of Hitler. So this was more or less the problem in which the genocide and the two world wars developed. And we are facing again this problem. My statement is the world is facing now more or less the same kind of problems that Europe faced 100 years ago. And the reason is very simple. It's because it's a conflict about the dimension of the techno-economic system and the political system. So why we had two world wars in Europe and not elsewhere? That's why. Because if the problem is you are having a techno-economic system which is overcoming the limits of national states, which are too small for that, you are going to have more problems where this development is faster and where the frontiers are smaller. That means Europe at the beginning of the 20th century. It's not that the Europeans were bad people or particular evil. It was about having the most developed techno-economic system and the smaller nations. That's why the war was in Europe and not in the United States or in other parts of the world. And this is the problem we're facing now, that the national states are becoming, even the European Union, is becoming small respect to the global universe, to the global techno-economic universe. And that's the thing to think about, how to solve. That's why the European experience is so important. It's not about being Eurocentric. It's about using the long experience of humanity on this kind of problem. The second possibility is not trying to be reactionary and going back to the past, but trying to be progressive and going towards the future, which is not coming back techno-economy and societies into the national level, but promoting democracy at the global level. And that's why we are speaking about. We need a world parliament in order to deal with the financial crisis, climate change, global terrorism, etc., etc., etc. We need a real international court, international criminal court, in order to put in jail the Africans who are committing genocide, but also the governance of the First World who are committing war crimes, for instance. And we need to develop regional system of democracy, because these are connected. If we are going to democratize the United Nations, a rational thing is thinking about the United Nations Security Council, in which the members are not representing national state, but the regions of the world. One chair for North America, another one for South America, one for Europe, one for Africa, and so on. But we need to build also regional institutions in order to deal with that, to represent the different parts of the world and the different experiences of the citizens of the world, which are so valid for building some kind of global democracy.
Well, we've talked about the United States and Europe, and you mentioned in the description of this talk the revolts in the Middle East. And it seems to me that if you're talking about democracy, I think we have mixed feelings about a democracy in the Middle East, because we don't really know what form of government or political faction will replace what's there. And so I think that the U.S. tends to be a little bit in conflict about it. So could you give us a perspective of what you just said and put in that the issue of the Middle East?
About the Middle East, yes. Well, if you want to fix a problem, you need to understand how the problem was raised, how the problem became so important. And let's go back for a while. From the end of the Second World War to 1950, there were three experiences of building political institutions. Three. Two of them were, one of the three experiences was directed in order to overcome the national frame and put in the national democracies into a bigger system and better coordinated system in a regional basis, which was the European Union. What's the idea of the European Union? It's the whole idea of the, from the origin of the creation of national state, which is basically people from different origins can live in the same society, have the same rights, and they can deal together. They can live in a mixed way, in the same space, and dealing with their problems in a democratic way. This was the creation of national democracies about, and this was the first experience of Europe becoming this kind of organization in which an Italian could go to work in France and they have a common currency, etc., etc. But we had another two experiences that were exactly the opposite thing. The idea of these experiences was people can live together. If they have different feelings, different religion, you have to separate them. And we had two experiences of that. One was in Asia. We separate Muslims in one part and put all of them in Pakistan. And then we keep all the rest inside India. And this is very good because they are not going to fight each other and they are going to keep the peace. But, we in 2002, we faced the risk of the first real atomic war in the history of war, meaning both continents had nuclear powers, India and Pakistan. We were very close. We went very close to that. And this was the result of a long experience of battles and the failure of the idea. And this was the idea of that was applied in the Middle East. Put the Jews here and put the Muslim there and keep the peace. This is perfect. No problem at all. So Middle East know the crucial part of the problem of the security and peace all over the world, based on the national feudal principle in which was people can live together. You have to separate them and you put a part there and the other part here and everything is going to be fixed. And it doesn't work. The idea of nation building, which was very progressive two centuries ago, it's completely reactionary in our world. And Middle East is about that. So what can we do about that? I don't know. But maybe we can use the experience of Europe. And remember that Europe was built with the help of, with a little help of our friends, meaning the United States, the Marshall Plan, you know. So the basic, if you read the real history of Europe, the decisive moment in which they arrived concretely to the idea of the European community of carbon and steel, which was 1950 declaration, Schuman Declaration, etc., it was because America, United States were pushing Europeans to be together and not in order not to start another war. And they say, well, we have a lot of money for the rebuilding of Europe, but we are going to give to you only if you work together. And we are not going to give this money to a single or to different nation. We are going to give this to a common agency in which you have to work together. This was the basic idea of building Europe. Why not Middle East? Why not the power? How many millions of dollars we are spending in security and military armament, etc., etc.? Why don't we put all this money in the hands of not the Israel in one hand and the Muslim in the other one, and the Muslim world in the other one? Put this in a common agency. If you are together and you can deal with the problems together, we are going to put the money. If not, we are not putting anyone. Your problem. I don't know. It sounds a little, you know, fast thinking. But I think that the principle has to be more or less the same. If we want they to cooperate, we can't just think, just build two national states, which is okay. Let's do it. I'm in favor. No, we can't go back to the original idea, which was a common state for Muslims and Jews together, living together. But this was, let me say, that this idea was defeated by realistic people who say, no, this is not going to work. Muslim and Jewish people can live together. We need to be realistic. These are the results. Because, and this is my last word about the Global Democracy Manifesto, somebody can say, well, this is utopia. This is something utopic. This is just blah, blah, blah. But let me say that what is utopic is thinking that a world which is becoming global in all the aspects can be keep going on in a progressive way without building global institutions. If you think that you can manage a global world through national states, this is real utopia. And it doesn't work. It didn't work in Middle East. It's not working properly at the global level right now. That's why we are having nuclear proliferation. Let's see when the first stupid boss of an ignored state just get the nukes on their rivals. And let's see when the water floods our cities, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So reality is that we are facing a new war. We are facing a different scale of human organization. This scale is global, and utopia is not about Global Democracy Manifesto. Utopia is thinking that you can deal with these amazing realities with the tools of the past. That's it.
Thank you for personalizing Global Manifesto. My question is, how do you see this in terms of the professional world parliament that has met in different areas? We were privileged to attend the 11th provisional world parliament in India, and I'd like to see how you feel this cooperation is.
Well, so, I think that the proposal I support the most is the initiative of the United Nations Parliamentary Assembly. I'm going to explain why. I think that the United Nations were a very, very important result of the tragedy of war. And, of course, the way in which the institution is organized is not proper for dealing with global problems. So the question is, if we are going just to throw out United Nations and say, they are bureaucrats, they are international, so we don't care about us, let's build something new, which is a proposal, or if we are going to try with that. I think we can arrive to the second stage of saying, so it doesn't work, let's try another thing. But only after we try. We didn't try. And the reality of the war, of the political world, is that national powers were not democratic at the beginning, and they changed it into democracy by pushing on them and asking them to create new institutions. Sometimes it happened almost without conflict, but sometimes it happened through conflict, like French Revolution or many other kind of revolutionary ways, in which the existing power decided not to keep the claims, just to reject, and at the end there was violence. But at the beginning it was a claim for changing the things and making things becoming more democratic. I think this is the case of the United Nations. United Nations Parliamentary Assembly is not about the United Nations. It's about a world parliament. This is the first step towards a world parliament. But if we are going to push to put on the table a world parliament, we need that millions, billions of human beings are in favor of that, because we're facing very important forces which are completely against that, you know. So that's why we need popular participation. But if we go to the street and ask here in the city of the Foundation of the United Nations to a people who are just on the walk side, and I say, what do you think about World Parliament? I say, what? I go, what? No, there is no connection still, you know. We need to build this connection before doing things, because if not, we are just proclaiming we are building this and we are doing that, and nobody cares. That's a problem. We need this connection. We need most of people all over the world knowing what is a World Parliament about. And what is better than this, than creating a United Nations Parliamentary Assembly and putting this on the table and putting all the governments all over the world to discuss the things and asking them to put in the hands of the United Nations Parliamentary Assembly the change from the Kyoto Protocol to a new one. Not the national governments who are concerned about their constituencies, but the parliamentarians, which usually are more friendly to this proposition. So we need to do that. We need political, social, political forces. And having a UNPA would be perfect for campaigning for a world parliament. You know, this is, in my opinion, the first step. That's it.
Well, usually the moderator has a chance to ask a question. And as you know, Professor Iglesias has been working very much as a political activist in his home country, Argentina. And as you have heard, he has already become a political activist at the global level. I think he's also been a political activist and promotes regional or continental democratic unions, federations. But since time has gone, maybe we should invite him back some other time to speak on the necessity or the movement for a South American parliament within a South American union, which is one of his major topics. So our thanks to Fernando Iglesias, speaker on a manifesto for global democracy, for enlightening us today. Incidentally, speaking of global democracy, as we've been doing, a year ago, I introduced a program on a United Nations Parliamentary Assembly, which Professor Iglesias just mentioned, and part of the title, and global democracy. So maybe global democracy may be the wave of the future. So we also thank our audience, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.